Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Acupuncture, herbal remedies, homeopathy, energy medicine, these practices are widely dismissed by the mainstream medical establishment as lacking any scientific backing. And yet, we all know someone with a story of a dramatic recovery attributed to such alternative practices. My next guest set out to bridge that disconnect. Melanie Warner's new book is The Magic Feather Effect: The Science of Alternative Medicine and the Surprising Power of Belief. Melanie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It is pretty clear in the early pages of the book that you're coming into this as a skeptic. You recount one scene. You're at a weekend conference and everybody's being woken up on Saturday morning by an energy dance, and you opt for the energy in your coffee cup instead, going the more, we might say, conventional route. Did you come into this wanting to validate alternative medicine or wanting to debunk it?
I came in with a little bit of both, but also neither. I didn't want to be a skeptic in the sense that I wanted to point out what was wrong with alternative medicine. And I wanted to look for people that were effective practitioners and really believed in what they were doing. But at the same time, I was also skeptical about how people talked about the ways in which their practices would work. So for energy healing, for instance, that there's this idea of life force energy moving through your body. I was skeptical about that. And for acupuncture, acupuncturists talk about qi, which is a similar idea, moving along meridian lines in the body. I didn't want to dismiss those out of hand and say, absolutely, this doesn't exist. So I was open and I went on a journey to try and understand whether there was any science behind some of those ideas. But I didn't find evidence for that.
And when you take something like acupuncture, which has been very well studied, over 1,000 studies, what does that science say? And is there any chance that the way that science is being done, potentially, probably by scientists who are extremely skeptical about the value of that treatment, that they're kind of missing something and maybe missing the actual effectiveness of the treatment?
Yeah, it's not a simple story when you look at the research. So usually these studies will be set up where a group of patients gets actual acupuncture, where the needles go into the body, the thin needles go in at really specific points along the body. And then another group of patients get a sham or a fake kind of acupuncture, where often they're using retractable needles that don't actually go into the skin, and sometimes they're put in the wrong places. And what you find with these studies is that there's not a big difference between the people who get the real acupuncture and the fake acupuncture. But a lot of studies that have been done in recent years have a third group, a group of patients that is just getting the usual care that they get from their doctor. So usually medication, doctor's visit, sometimes exercise. And when you look at that group compared to both types of acupuncture, the real and the fake, you see these interesting effects where people are getting relief. People are feeling like their pain is reduced. They have more mobility. They feel better. Their quality of life, all of these things are improved relative to what people are normally getting. So there's two ways to look at that. The skeptics say, oh, that's not valuable. I came away, and a lot of other scientific researchers come away, with the view that, look, if these things are working better than the available treatments that we have, and they might be working for reasons that we don't fully understand, and that certainly are not the way acupuncturists say it works. And that encompasses things like placebo effects, the interaction between the acupuncturist and the person getting the treatment, and all these kind of what scientists sometimes call non-specific effects of medicine. And there's a thinking among researchers that these aspects are actually very important in treatments.
Melanie Warner, one of the things that you kind of conclude is that there are a lot of reasons that might explain individual people's accounts of healing and recovery. But of course, in the title of your book, you say it's the power of belief. What I took away from the book and what you seem to be saying just now is that it's not just about the belief of the person who's receiving the treatment. It's almost more about perhaps the attention and the empathy being given to them by the practitioner, that maybe that's actually the most powerful part of some of these treatments.
Yeah, it's not just the conscious belief when we think of, oh, I think this treatment is going to help me. It's the whole experience that you have in what scientists call the therapeutic encounter. And this can be powerful in a medical setting too, but there's a strong argument to be made that some of these elements are much more prevalent in alternative medicine. So like you mentioned, empathy, sometimes alternative practitioners, they'll sit down and they'll talk with patients about things happening in their life, not just like, well, how's your back? But it can be, not always, but it can be a much more supportive and holistic approach. The complaint sometimes is that doctors treat the disease and not the patient. And not that doctors can't, and there are some very, very good doctors out there, but the system isn't really set up to help them do that. You know, appointments are very short. They're seeing many, many patients during the day. In some ways, it's not as fair for them because they have a lot more on their plate in terms of conditions that they have to treat and tests they have to run, and they have to make sure they're not missing anything very, very serious. Whereas our alternative practitioners are seeing kind of a more finite set of conditions. But yeah, all those elements of attention and support, and also this feeling of safety, right? Those things have been, you know, largely dismissed in the past by science, and now they're starting to be taken seriously as real elements of medicine.
I guess I would maybe separate those from what you would call a placebo, because as you're saying, those are things that we can measure and say these are things that are having an effect. The placebo effect of, you know, taking an empty pill seems to be a little bit different. How much do we understand about how that works and how powerful it can be?
Yeah, there are different types of placebos and then different types of placebo effects. So the example of a sugar pill, which is a classic example, is a more simple placebo. It mostly involves the expectation of relief, like I take this pill, I'm going to feel better because my doctor has told me or I believe it. And then there's also the ritual of taking a pill. People think that is important too. Just the practice of getting it out of the container, putting it in your mouth, getting a glass of water, that ritual has a kind of conditioning effect as well. But then other types of placebos can be a lot more complex and rich, like some of the things that we've just been talking about. And some of those can happen in an alternative setting and also in a conventional setting. Like one of the most effective placebos is surgery. You see, when studies have been done where people get these fake surgeries, like just an incision on their knee or in their back, as opposed to the real full surgery, there are these really robust effects where people feel better and it lasts for sometimes years for people.
Wow.
And you have a lot going on with surgery. You have incredibly complex rituals. You have the belief that this is a highly trained person that is going in and fixing your body. A lot of people feel safe. You know, they feel like, okay, I'm finally going to get this fixed now. So all those things are what we now know go into producing really interesting placebo effects.
I think when we say the phrase placebo effect, we kind of associate it with dismissing what's happening, the results of that, that it's just, it's kind of a figment of our imaginations. But you, as you're digging into this research, highlight the fact that, in fact, there are some people who respond more strongly to placebo effects, as you were just saying, the different kinds of placebos that you could use and the different types of ailments that they might treat. And in a lot of cases, the placebo effect can have real physiological effects, right?
Yeah, scientists, I think, have just scratched the surface in understanding how placebo effects work. They're really, it all leads back to the brain, which one neuroscientist calls it the most complex known thing in the universe, which is really saying something when you consider black holes and all the other elements of space that we don't understand at all. So you have 80 billion neurons with the possibility of 100 trillion connections between them. So the complexity is immense. And so scientists have started trying to understand a little bit about what happens in the brain when you experience a placebo effect, because that's where it all starts. Sometimes there's a possibility that it can go beyond the brain and into the body with certain types of placebo effects. But for the most part, you're really changing wiring in the brain. You're releasing neurotransmitters. One of the most well-known mechanisms is for pain. And the thinking is there's probably different placebo effects for pain, but the one that scientists understand the most about is the release of endorphins in your brain. They're very similar to opiates, and these attach to receptor cells that actually block signals or tone down signals that are coming up from your body. And so your brain does not produce pain.
You say in the book, and I think it was someone you spoke to said to you, there's not a one-to-one relationship between physical bodily damage and the experience of pain. But in reading this book, I found myself kind of caught in this circular logical loop of, you know, the pain we feel may not be correlated to physical damage. At the same time, our brain might be able to fix pain, but it's not going to fix physical damage. I mean, we're kind of caught in this weird loop of what is actually real, what is damage or illness or disease, and whether or not it needs to be fixed.
Exactly. I mean, pain is a fascinating phenomenon. It's a harm alarm. It prevents us from injuring ourselves. People that are born with a congenital condition where they can't feel pain don't have a very long life expectancy. You know, it's an incredibly valuable survival tool. But at the same time, the system can go awry, and it can lead us to believe that our body is in greater hurt or greater danger than it is. One of the fascinating stories was a man who was the first person to study placebo effects. He was at Harvard in the 30s and 40s, and he's an anesthesiologist. He was sent over to World War II in Italy in these battlefield hospitals, and he saw patients coming in with these horrific wounds coming off the battlefield. And he was stunned by the fact that very few of them said they were in great pain, and very few of them asked for or wanted morphine. And he thought, well, something's got to be going on with this. And he wondered if they were all in shock, and he determined that most of them weren't. And he later did a study. He compiled some data from the war zone, and then he compared it to civilians back in Boston at hospitals when they had come in from some kind of trauma, usually car accidents. He found that about 30% of the battlefield soldiers asked for pain medications, and 80% of the civilians did. And this was incredibly revealing to him, because it showed that pain wasn't what he thought it was and what everyone thought it was. So there's a lot of modulation that our beliefs are the stories we tell. And this man at Harvard, Henry Beecher was his name, his theory was that the meaning that a hospital had was very different for the soldiers versus the civilians. The soldiers felt that they were safe, that they were off the battlefield, they were attended by doctors and nurses, and they were probably going to go home soon. The civilians, on the other hand, had just gotten in some horrible accident and were heading into a world of uncertainty where they were going to have to deal with eventually going back to their normal daily life with some major injury. So he determined that those beliefs and those stories, those narratives, those expectations could have a profound effect on whether or not the brain produces pain and how much.
Melanie Warner, your new book, The Magic Feather Effect, is kind of predicated on the idea that there are these two different categories of scientifically based medical treatments, conventional medicine, and non-scientific alternative medicine. At the end of the book, you actually kind of call for conventional doctors and alternative healers to each learn from each other and maybe be a little bit more like each other. What would that look like in your mind?
Yeah, I think one of the things that's keeping alternative therapies, especially ones that have been well studied like acupuncture, keeping them alternative, in quotes, is the fact that they have not embraced a more scientific theory to how their practices work. So still talking about qi and meridians. And it's not that, I'm not trying to argue that, oh, we should stop talking about this. I mean, these are steeped in hundreds of years or thousands of years of history. But one acupuncturist I talked to, who happens to also be a researcher at Harvard, he had an interesting way of thinking about it. He, you know, as a scientist, he's not trying to look for the existence of qi and meridians. He thinks of these things as kind of as metaphors for how to treat patients and for just a kind of a different holistic, poetic, almost understanding of the body. But I think in order for alternative medicine to move forward, I think they need to have a little bit more of an open embrace of, let's think about what are the active ingredients in our practices. Let's consider placebo effects. Let's consider other mind-body interactions. Let's consider the kind of non-specific aspect of touch and the healing effects that can have, and not focus so much on life force energy moving in the body. On the other side, conventional medicine and doctors can benefit by understanding the way that alternative practitioners are healers, for lack of a better word. All the stuff we were talking about earlier about really sitting down and listening to patients and understanding what's going on and using their powers of intuition to figure out what people really need and how they need to be treated and understood.
Melanie Warner's new book is The Magic Feather Effect, The Science of Alternative Medicine and the Surprising Power of Belief. Melanie, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.